Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami.
The way of practice is usually a rocky or thorny path for most of us. And at the same time, I'm reminded of words of wisdom that I received from my parents when I was small. And one of them I often think of, my father always telling me to sit up straight, and realizing what wise and profound advice that was. I didn't necessarily appreciate it when I was a teenager. Another phrase that springs to mind is count your blessings. Probably most English people have heard that, and I think in this environment particularly, it's a very good practice to count your blessings. There to be so much so easy to take for granted, the fact that we're fed every day, we have kutis to live in, that we have good friends. If we reflect on these things constantly, then our discontent with the progress that we're making or not making in practice is very much reduced, and just to see how much blessings that we do have, and we don't have to compromise. We don't feel strange or freakish in wanting to get up at 3 a.m. and meditate. We can do things like not talk for 2 or 3 weeks, or fast for a couple of weeks, and nobody's going to think us strange or weird. In fact, people support us, encourage us, praise us for doing things like this. Can even refrain from laying down for a month or 2 months or 3 months, and nobody thinks that's strange. So we have a great deal of freedom to do that which is our heart's deepest desire, that which we most want to do, and we can do that in a monastery. So at the same time as in conventional sense, our life is a very constrained one. But it is through that external constraint that we learn, or we come to experience, an inner freedom. My I also reflect a lot on the debt of gratitude that we all have to our parents. And a story that told, which is now quite well known in Thailand, I think, relates to a time when I was traveling through Iran. And I was pretty well down and out and living rough. in an alleyway and relying on alms. And someone had given me a few reals. I can't remember what the Irani currency is now. And I knew of a soup kitchen, soup shop, where they give you a big bowl of soup for a very small amount of money and all the bread that you can eat. So I was walking towards this soup shop across Tehran. It was morning time. People were going to work. And I passed a woman, obviously just come out of her house on her way to work. And she looked at me in a very kind of disgusted fashion. I must admit, I was pretty disgusting. So it was a reasonable reaction. And she walked over to me and looked very stern. And she just sort of pointed at me and sort of said, told me to go with her. So I followed this lady and we went back. It was obviously to the flat where she lived and went up in the lift, and she didn't say a word to me the whole time. I didn't know what was going to happen. And went into her flat, and then still very gruffly or sternly, she just pointed to the kitchen and sat me down, and then put all this food for me and just stood there and watched me eat till I was full. And then she called her son and barked out something in Persian, and then a few minutes later her son came with a clean shirt and a pair of trousers, and so she made sort of indications that my present outfit was deserved to be incinerated, and pointed me to the bathroom and told me to go and have a shower and change my clothes. So I did that and walked out. She looked at me, okay, pointed at the door. We walked out, down in the lift, got out into the road. She just walked off. Never spoke a word the whole time. So I was obviously very impressed by this. I learned so much of gratitude to this lady. And sometime later, I was thinking, you know, how inspiring I found this woman and other people who assisted me in various ways when I was traveling. And how, you know, I was sure that I'd never forget this woman and what she did for me. And yet I thought, but I have so much gratitude for this woman who just gave me one meal and a shower. I lived with my parents for almost 18 years and they gave me 3 meals a day, gave me all the clothes that I ever needed to wear. Gave me everything I ever needed, and if I got sick, they were more worried about it than I was. And I thought, and I never actually sort of ever felt very much about it. I actually feel more grateful to this woman than I did to my own mother and father. And I realized, you know, that how shallow my thinking had been about this, and just how much I had received from my parents without ever giving it a second thought. And since I've been in the monastery, then it seems to me that unresolved issues with parents are a major obstacle in spiritual life, and unwillingness to forgive parents for not being perfect or for not being who we want them to be, or to be for having greed, hatred and delusion and being patujanas. And that's something which really needs to be looked at and dealt with, because it's, there's something there which really undermines spiritual practice. To use a hackneyed phrase, it's a kind of a wound and something which has to be healed. So there are so many contributory factors and causes to progress or regress in practice. But developing this warm and spacious heart and recognition of our blessings and the things that we've been given, and most basically at all, been given this life. And so even if your parents were cruel and heartless and treated you in terrible ways, or abandoned you on a rubbish tip, or whatever, then at the very least they gave you this human life, which is so incredibly precious. And the fact that you're here and that you're able to practice Buddha's teachings is because of your parents. So this is where we have these chants at the end of every the morning and the evening session, where we share our merits, particularly with our parents for all that they've given us. So that counting our blessings, counting the things that we are given, and counting the things, the small victories that we've achieved, the goodness that we've created and shared with others, is a way of giving your mind a real cushion and a basic sense of well-being, which enables you to bear with the ups and downs of practice, the difficult times, the disappointments, the disillusionments that inevitably come. And there is a point, I think, in everyone's practice where you realize there's a lot more to this than I thought. You know, this is a lot bigger job than I thought. You know, this isn't just a 10-day retreat job. You know, this is 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, if we're lucky. And this is why I feel that the acceptance of the faith in the Buddhist teachings of samsara are so helpful. Some monks, some people say, take the agnostic view, you know, don't worry about the sort of other realms, past lives, future lives, you know, just concentrate on the present life, and that sounds quite reasonable. But at the same time, your attitude to the teachings of samsara affects your attitude to your present life. And if you believe that you've been born many, 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 many lifetimes, then 10 years or 20 years of meditation practice, or 30 years or 40 years, it's the blink of an eye. If you take one life, then, wow, having to do this for 5 years or 10 years, it's a really big deal. But that view is based on the idea of just one lifetime, isn't it? Counting your blessings, then you feel, well, there's nothing else I'd rather do anyway. There's a sense of doing what should be done, doing what needs to be done. That's a refuge. And using the mind which is calmed, restrained, to awaken to the truth of seeing, the truth of life, these three characteristics of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, of not self. These are not Buddhist theories, it's not Theravadin philosophy. This is the nature of existence. All we have to do is to open our eyes to it. And the more mindfulness you have, the calmer your mind, the less the agitation and distraction, the less time you spend on unwholesome thoughts and projections, imagination, memories, then the more time, the more capacity you have for recognizing the impermanence of things. And these teachings are, in a way, quite straightforward, and teaching of impermanence. But there's a world of difference between accepting the idea of impermanence and penetrating it in your experience. There's probably, surely nobody in the world, in any culture or professing any religion, who would deny that things change. But there's a certain point in which that perception of change changes you. And that only comes about through practice. In seeing that nothing lasts, what the profound repercussions, implications of that simple truth that nothing lasts. And recognizing the extent to which we are looking for a happiness that lasts in things that don't last. This is the basic kind of mistake that we make as human beings, because we don't remind ourselves, we don't want to see that things don't last. There's always a hope. You know, that it's the famous story of Mullah Nasruddin looking for the sweet chili in the sack of chilies. You know, perhaps sooner or later, one day, he'll find the sweet chili. And this hope, this longing, you know, that one day we'll find the sankhara, it's like the sweet chili, it won't be impermanent and unsatisfactory and impersonal like the rest. You know, and the rational side of mind says, no, it's not possible, but still there's this emotional longing. You see this when people are together and you say, if only we could make this moment last forever. Yeah. I want this evening to last forever. I mean, you only say that because you know that it doesn't. You know? Be pretty miserable if it did, wouldn't it? Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, people think we could be together, but you know it doesn't work. It doesn't last. And nothing lasts. You can't be excited for any length of time because your body gets tired, and excitement is tiring. You can't enjoy anything for very long, can you? How long can you enjoy anything before it gets boring? Not very long. So it's a matter of turning one's attention to recognizing these simple truths. It's not complex. You don't have to use a lot of brain work to see the three characteristics. You just have to restrain the conditioned tendency to complicate things and to interpret and evaluate and just to be with this simple truth that things change. Because at the moment that you experience a mood, it's not obvious. Moods seem real, and the more intense they are, the more real they seem. And we attach to them because of that. So it's like clutching at straws, drowning man clutching at straws, and the person without wisdom is clutching at anything to give some sense of solidity, reality. The seeing that nothing lasts, and that nothing, as nothing lasts, nothing can give you any permanent happiness. Nothing can do it for you. Nothing is going to give you a permanent high. Even heaven realms, they're not permanent. You get to the end of your time in heaven and you notice because the flowers around your neck, they start to wither. And all the other devas, they notice and they just shun you. You know, before you've been kind of the life and soul of the party, you've got 500 young heavenly maidens going out with you, gathering daisies and making them into chains and having a great time, you know, for eons, and then suddenly the flowers start to fade. And your seat gets hot and all these kind of subtle changes, and suddenly, you know, you've been sent to heaven realm's version of Coventry. Nobody wants to know you. And intense suffering, and then bump, you know, you're down in a far less pleasant place. So even heaven realms are not permanent. They don't last. So where we, you know, we all want to be happy. So where are we going to look for happiness? And this is what the Buddha said before. You know, I was subject to birth. Look for happiness in things subject to birth, subject to aging. Look for happiness and fulfillment in things subject to aging. Subject to death. Look for happiness and fulfillment in things suffering. Subject to death. And then the Buddha made the Bodhisattva medicine and jump. Perhaps there is something which is not born. It doesn't age, doesn't die. And so he embarked on what he called the noble search, as in the search for material pleasures, experiences, search for liberation. This is the noble search, the Aryasana. So noticing in experience how there is this sense of search and longing, desire to somehow squeeze something out of experience. There's something we want that we're not getting. There's a sense of missing something, there's a sense of hollowness, sense of lack, which is what drives people. The world, and it drives them to search for ways of filling that hole, of taking away that lack in precisely those things which gave rise to it in the first place. And this is like Sisyphus, you know, the famous image of Sisyphus pushing the rock up to the top of the hill, and then it falls all the way down again. And just how people's search becomes narrowed and becomes so constricted, and how willing people are to take second best. You know? And sometimes I speak with people who come in the morning, and there's a sense of sadness. And speaking with a couple of elders, senior civil servant in the Customs and Excise Department for 30 years, you know, it was something that he was. this was his pride in life, and it wasn't unwholesome. It's just so sad that was the extent of his search, and that how little people take from their lives, how little they find, how little they even want to find. And just the narrowness and the lack in people's lives, and how they try to fill them in such unsuccessful and stopgap kind of ways, when there's just so much more to life, isn't there? The moment you start to meditate and to practice, and just to see that it's just a whole universe that most people are not even aware exists. Whole new possibilities, capacities. So the more peaceful your mind is, the less the prejudices, the less the bias, the less the insecurity, the clearer you see things. And Ajahn Chah said, everything teaches you the Dhamma. The trees teach you the Dhamma, the leaves on the ground, the creatures coming up in your kuti at night, and the termites and the ants and the weather and everything. When your mind is free of that incessant gabbling within, and you're sensitive, it's a new kind of sensitivity. It's not like sensitive to other people's words or their ideas about you or what they're doing, but it's a sensitivity to the three characteristics. You begin to see there's no controller here. No. Realize you don't have to be guilty about who you are. And begin to see where you invest the sense of self, where you create the sense of self, in the physical body, in the feelings, in the perceptions and thoughts, in consciousness. We attach to things because we want to attach to them. We delight in them. Certain thoughts, certain perceptions, certain memories that we delight in. They give us a sense of warmth and solidity which we enjoy. And this is the courage that is needed in practice. It's not necessarily the courage to face rampaging elephants in rut or tigers and things in the jungle, but it's the courage to deconstruct this kind of empire of self that you've created and gradually let go bit by bit of this empire you've created. And just allowing the body to be just the body, feelings to be just feelings, thoughts to be just thoughts, perceptions to be just perceptions, and there doesn't have to be someone standing behind it, controlling it all. There isn't. And the point is, it's not a teaching that you should not attach. Don't attach, it's bad. Buddha says don't attach. If you attach, Buddha's going to punish you. It's because you can't attach. You're on a fool's mission. You may think you can attach. You can't. You can't attach to anything because it doesn't last. It's changing. Crumbles. But it's that effort to attach or to clutch at straws moment by moment. That is the crux of the matter. See? worrying, desiring, and look, stopping and looking. This is samatha and vipassana, very easy. Stop and look. If you haven't stopped, you can't see anything very much because you're moving too fast, like in a moving vehicle. You stop and you can see. You stop, you look, you see. If you can't stop, then you can look, but you won't see very clearly. It's a blur. So these are the intentions we have, the intention to stop, to restrain. And the image here is not holding something down, it's a kind of suppression, just holding it down. The moment you take your hand away, it's going to bounce up again. The idea is the way that you'd restrain a bouncing ball. You know, you restrain the bouncing ball and it's still. You know, there's not any kind of tension in that bouncing ball anymore. You still it. And it's a movement of stilling and stopping or arresting the motion of things. And when there's that stillness and there's a clarity and a mindfulness there, you see. And some teachers say the clarity there, it's just like you're looking at a wall and you can see every single particle in the wall. Clarity. See, oh, this is like this, and see the causes and conditions that underlie it, how it's sustained moment by moment through causes and conditions. The moment any of those causes and conditions change, then the product of the causes and conditions change. Whatever arises, due to causes and conditions, passes away due to causes and conditions. Conditioned nature of phenomena. This is something that just reveals itself to you when you're willing to stop and look. Without having any kind of ideas about it, any philosophies, just looking. When you stop and you look and afterwards, recollecting or evaluating what you saw, if you had to put it into words, you wouldn't be able to find any words other than anicchang, dukkhang, anatta. And those who've practiced well and realized stream entry, realized one of the levels of enlightenment, whatever their insight, whatever their practice, if they had to summarize what they'd seen and say, all sankharas are impermanent, all sankharas are suffering, all dhammas are anatta. So you set yourself on the right track, initially, with the thinking mind, dwelling on the ideas of anicchang, dukkhang, anatta as a basis, and then learning to stop and look and recognize. So in the words of Ajahn Buddhadasa, you see that nothing is worth having, nothing is worth being. It's just not worth it. It's just that much. You say, well, I've got this, and I've got that, and I've become this, and I've got that, and then, so what? And this is the unanswerable question. You know, for the Patujana, so what? So Ajahn Chah says, remember when we practice, you suddenly realize you're a bird in a cage. And he says, once you realize you're a bird in a cage, it doesn't matter how beautiful the cage is and whether the bars are made of gold, whether the swing is diamond studded and whatever. Once you realize you're a bird in a cage, then you just want to get out. That's when the real energy in practice comes, through this realization, the extent to which you are unfree, the extent to which you're conditioned, the extent to which you're being deprived of your birthright, of that which you most deeply desire, and that which really justifies or gives your life meaning and purpose. That freedom from craving, freedom from attachment, which the Buddha said is something within our reach, if we truly aspire to it, and if we create the necessary causes and conditions. So there's that sutta where the Buddha compares the practitioner to the chicken. The chicken doesn't have to make a lot of vows and doesn't have to sit there and think, please may my chicks break their way out of the eggs, and please may they be born safely, and so on. So all the mother chicken has to do is sit on those eggs. And sooner or later, you know, the warmth, the causes and conditions will be created, and the chicks will hatch out. But if the mother chicken is just sitting a few yards away from the eggs, in a comfy chair, reading Poultry Times, having a cup of chicken soup, I'm thinking, please may my children be born safely. Please may they quickly be born. And may all the virtuous powers in the universe help my children to be born. Very piously staring. It doesn't actually ever sit on the eggs, you see. Eggs. And the chicks are not born because the causes and conditions have not been created. So the Buddha says, you know, the causes and conditions for enlightenment are not esoteric. There's not a secret teaching. And the Buddha doesn't hold back certain teachings, you know, that are sort of whispered in your ear after you become an initiate. It's not some kind of initiation involved here. It's all very straightforward. You need faith, you need effort, you need mindfulness, you need concentration, you need wisdom. Now, you develop the Noble Eightfold Path, sitting on the eggs. So, I'm going to sit on our eggs a bit. Okay.